Well, I thought watching pregame last night for Sunday Night Football that the weather was going to be the ugliest thing about that game, and I was wrong. It was the entire Tampa Bay Buccaneers game plan. That was the ugliest thing about the game last night. But what a game we had. What a whole Sunday we had. Again, some intriguing games, some really close games coming down to the wire. I mean, it was another fun Sunday and a fun weekend, too. College football, fun to have the Pac-12 back. Got to see the first look at what a 9 a.m. game would look like there. We'll talk about that a little later on in the show. And also, of course, NASCAR as well. A fun championship race there in Phoenix yesterday, so we'll talk about that a little later on. Of course, we'll end the day off taking a look at the exciting Monday Night Football matchup tonight. Really hope that my sarcasm got through the mic there. But let's go ahead and jump into what was another intriguing day of NFL football yesterday. Matt Ryan now goes to 10-3 in his career against AFC West teams, although Denver once again trying to make another incredible fourth quarter comeback. Afternoon against the Chargers, they outscored the Atlanta Falcons 21-7 in the fourth quarter yesterday. Entered the quarter down 27-6. They get the 20-yard pass from Locke to Judy to make it 27-13. Then, of course, Todd Gurley, his 4-yard run to put him up 34-13. But then again, Drew Locke, 9-yard pass from Tim Patrick, then had a 10-yard run to make it 34-27. So Denver hanging around and making Atlanta again earn it. And as I was watching Denver, you know, as they made it 34-20, I thought, look at that. The Broncos going to go out at least fighting there in Atlanta. Then they made it 34-27 with just under 2 minutes to go. And I was just sitting there going, is Atlanta going to blow another game this season? It's like the Falcons and the Chargers are trying to have their own little competition here to see who can blow the most games this season. But Atlanta able to hold on to the win over Denver 34-27. They go down to 3-6 on the year. Denver 3-5. But Matt Ryan continues to see success against Atlanta, and he had a nice day yesterday, 25 for 35, 284 yards, 3 touchdowns, interception. I mean, that's the thing with Atlanta. Again, this is a team that's played some solid games this season. The collapses in the fourth quarter against Dallas and Chicago have just been really puzzling, and sometimes, you know, they just haven't seemed to play up to the level that they've shown us. Because again, this game, this is a team that looked well put together. They were completing drives. I mean, this was an Atlanta Falcons team that we've seen glimpses of this season, but just haven't been able to finish it off. And they almost blew it again yesterday, but able to hold on and beat Denver there by a touchdown at home. And then the Seahawks got a nice little awakening there from the Buffalo Bills. The Bills, who I was starting to get a little worried about with the two losses they had had on the season to Kansas City and to Tennessee, but able to just pull themselves back up there and have a strong performance at home against Seattle. I mean, that is a tough team to do what Buffalo did to them, and just an unbelievable job that Buffalo was able to do. I mean, 7-2 start for the first time since 1993. Josh Allen, 31 of 38 for 415 yards with 3 touchdowns. Stephon Diggs had a 9-catch day for 118 yards as well. That defense was putting constant pressure on Russell Wilson. I mean, that was an all-around stellar game for Buffalo to get to 7-2 and really look like, I mean, they were looking like the team at that point. I mean, they've been the standouts of the AFC East really all year, it's felt like, and they did a heck of a job there against Seattle. But there was a game in the afternoon session that may have put the rest of the AFC East on notice. But nonetheless, at that point, Buffalo making a huge statement against Seattle and a solid win there. Never really let Seattle get into it. I mean, they had a 14-0 lead, did Buffalo, at the end of the first quarter. They had a 24-10 lead at halftime. It wasn't until close to the end of the third quarter, when it was 27-20, that Buffalo had the lead, where it looked like Seattle was possibly really getting back into this game. And you look at the fourth quarter, and how does Buffalo, you know, start off the fourth quarter? Well, you know, just 2 touchdown drives. 41-20 was the lead there, just under 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. So Buffalo, when Seattle looked like they were going to close back in, did a great job of expanding that lead back out. And, I mean, that's what championship-caliber teams can do. And Buffalo, not saying that they are to that level yet, but they are definitely looking like the class of the AFC East this year. And that was a strong performance put on by the Bills at home. And the Ravens and the Colts. Baltimore gets a 14-point lead on their way to setting a new NFL record. There are 20-plus points in 31 straight games. That is an NFL record, although still not the Baltimore team that we saw last year. I mean, they got a nice special teams or a defensive touchdown there with Chuck Clark's 65-yard fumble return for a touchdown in the first quarter. But they didn't have an offensive touchdown until over halfway through the third quarter, until Gus Edwards had his one-yard touchdown run that put Baltimore in the lead, 14-10. That offense, again, just doesn't really seem to show up. And I'm waiting for, you know, that Baltimore Ravens offense of last season, that explosive, you know, you can barely stop type offense to really pick back up. And it seems like every week they're just kind of missing that last cylinder, missing that last bit of burst, that last little kind of just edge to them that isn't there like it was last year. I mean, for them not to score an offensive touchdown until almost the end of the third quarter, I mean, a little over 5.5 minutes left in that quarter when they did, but I mean, that's just not the offense we remember from this Baltimore Ravens team. So they do have 20-plus points in 31 straight games, but they have looked a rocky 6-2 at times this year. So, and then Indianapolis, you know what? I think they're still playing well. The fact that, again, kind of on the flip side to that point I just made, the fact that they kept Baltimore's offense out of the end zone until almost the end of the third quarter, that's solid work from the Indianapolis Colts. And even though Phillip Rivers had maybe one of the worst tackle attempts in NFL history, I mean, it's not even like a juke put him down. He kind of tripped himself. I mean, granted, the, you know, Baltimore defender kind of held up a little bit, but he pretty much kind of went down on his own and then tried to make this crazy off-his-back type tackle that just didn't go well at all. But the Colts, I still feel like, put up a solid effort against Baltimore. The Ravens, you know, kind of lucky to get the win yesterday in Indianapolis. And again, they're 6-2, but just have not looked like that same kind of contender that we saw last year. So we'll see. You know, how they look in their upcoming games. They got the Patriots November 15th. They'll be on the road against New England before they're at home against Tennessee. And then after that, they'll be on the road against the Steelers. The next three games, you know, kind of increasing in difficulty from New England to Tennessee to Pittsburgh. So we'll see. I'm really interested to see how that rematch goes between the Ravens and the Steelers, seeing as how the first game was so close. But Baltimore able to get that win, set the NFL record, get to 6-2, try to keep in contact there with Pittsburgh at the top of the AFC North. And looking at the AFC South, the Texans are pretty dang happy they've gotten to play Jacksonville twice this year. Otherwise, they'd be a winless team. As Houston beats Jacksonville for the second time, they sweep the Jaguars. That's now 6 straight wins for Houston against Jacksonville. Although, again, a team that made it really interesting there towards the end, as Houston look to somewhat be in control of this game. I mean, they had, you know, a 13-7 lead at one point. They were trying to pull away. They had a 27-16 lead a little over halfway through the third quarter. Then Jacksonville making a little bit of a comeback, a field goal before the end of the third, and a late touchdown there on Lutton's 13-yard run. The two-point conversion again failed. We could have been looking at overtime if they had completed that. But Jacksonville, you know, hanging in there. I think that just, again, shows you how off Houston is this year. Because I think about that team last year, and I feel like this would have been a total – both games would have been totally different this year with the way Houston would have dominated Jacksonville. But this year, I think that shows you how much Houston really has struggled. The fact they've only been able to beat the Jaguars, and although their first win was fairly, you know, a fairly handy one, 30-14, this game, again – just shows that this Houston team is just not where I expected them to be, and I think where they really should have been this season. They've been way below the expectations this year. And then in terms of Jacksonville, you know, Jake Luton, not a bad first appearance. 26 of 38, 304 yards, a touchdown and an interception through the air. But he did have the one carry for 13 yards and a touchdown there at the end. So, you know, I think he did a pretty good job. I don't know where Jacksonville's going to go as soon as Minshew was able to come back. But I think for the most part, Jacksonville's found a quarterback that got into some rhythm yesterday and has given them a good chance of being competitive. I mean, I thought when Minshew went down, Houston was going to have a much easier day over Jacksonville. And Jake Luton able to give them a fighting chance. I mean, had that touchdown that put them in a position to possibly get the two-point conversion and tie it up, they didn't get it. Jacksonville still pretty competitive in that game against Houston. But both teams just bottom of the division, obviously, with Texans at 2-6 and Jaguars at 1-7. So Houston can just be happy that they ended up playing Jacksonville twice and got those two wins, because they may not win again this year. We'll see. And then the Panthers and the Chiefs. Talk about a game that had a little bit of a surprise to it. I mean, obviously, Carolina getting Christian McCaffrey back, you expected them to be a little more competitive. But to perform the way that they did over Kansas City, I mean, the Chiefs did not have the lead the whole first half. The closest they came was 14-13, but then with Joey Sly's 47-yard field goal there at the end with about 46 seconds left in the half, Carolina got back to a four-point lead. It wasn't until under 5 minutes in the third quarter when Patrick Mahomes connected 4 yards out to Clyde Edwards-Helaire that Kansas City was able to take the lead at 20-17. So the Panthers having a solid offensive day, but their defense as well was able to make some good plays there in the first half, really throughout most of the third quarter as well. But there just comes a time where that Kansas City offense clicks, and they got the go-ahead score in the third quarter. They went really kind of, you know, increased their lead at the start of the fourth. Carolina kept fighting, but Kansas City able to do what they do and just close out games, get the win there 31-33. Although Carolina did have the ball there at the end, and I mean, it was a gutsy call to try to go for that kind of a field goal, but ultimately, what else were you really going to do? I mean, they really hadn't gotten too much going offensively at the end of that drive, so why not? Why not take a chance, see if your kicker can make history and give you a huge upset win in the process? I thought it was, it's a gutsy decision. You were going to need one in that case. Came up a little short there, but well, actually way off, not just short, but way off the field goal. But Kansas City able to hold on there, get the win at home 33-31. Where they've looked, I mean, their one loss this year has come at home, and they sometimes, I feel like, can get a little too settled into a false sense of security there at Arrowhead Stadium. So Carolina almost got the better of them there. But Kansas City able to hold on. And then Minnesota, the strong win over Detroit. Nothing really to say out of this game except another incredible performance from Dalvin Cook. 200-plus scrimmage yards, 2-plus TDs in two straight games. He's and really apparently enjoyed running on his division rivals this year with the game he had against Green Bay. And then the kind of game he had against Detroit. Good win for Minnesota. Nothing really coming from either of these teams. Stafford got the okay there right at the right before the game essentially got started. But nonetheless, didn't do a whole lot. Not that I thought it would. But Minnesota able to get the solid win, 34-20 over Detroit. And the Tennessee-Chicago game, that's an interesting game because Tennessee does win 24-17. However, I don't know how I feel about Tennessee after this game, because the 24-3 lead, when Tennessee had that lead just over 8 minutes to go in the game, I thought, you know what, this is the kind of performance that Tennessee really, you know, they needed. They need to get their confidence back up. They need to see themselves again as that contender. You know, Ryan Tannehill, 10-21, 158 yards, 2 touchdowns. Seeing him, you know, kind of have that performance again, that's really what Tennessee needed. But then what got me a little nervous about the Titans is they really let Chicago back into it there. I mean, 2 touchdowns right around the last 5 minutes or so of the game make it 24-17. That game was a lot closer than it really should have been at the end. Tennessee, I feel like, kind of got overconfident. They weren't closing out the game like they should have, and really it just became a little too easy there for Chicago at the end. Tennessee, it should have been closer to that 24-3, maybe 24-10 scoreline. The fact Chicago got it back to a touchdown, I mean, the Bears still fighting to the end, that's great. But if you're Tennessee and you want to be a real contender there in the AFC with what the play that we've seen from some of those teams like Pittsburgh, like Kansas City, then you got to know how to finish games off. You got a team in that position. If the Bears almost mount to come back against the Titans with the way they've been playing lately, that makes me a little more nervous for Tennessee. Not as impressed by Chicago. You know, again, good fight till the end, but I'm a little nervous about Tennessee after the way that game ended than any kind of higher on Chicago. And the Giants able to hold off the Washington football team. Daniel Jones now 4-0 in his career against Washington, 1-16 against all others, but he's probably happy he gets to play Washington twice a year. But another solid game from them. Kyle Allen now goes down, likely needs some surgery on his ankle, so Alex Smith is deemed the guy moving forward, and you know, he was thrown into the game yesterday, so the fact there was two interceptions to close out the game for Washington, I'm not going to hold that really against him. I think as he gets a whole week now to kind of prepare to be the starter, it'll be different. I'm excited to see, you know, Alex Smith back out there now as a starting quarterback for Washington. Was not expecting that really at all at the start of the year. So the fact that we've seen him now twice in fill-in roles, now we'll get to see him as a starter. I'm excited to see what he can do and just how he can command that Washington team, because they had a good drive, about 10 plays. They had some good momentum going before the interception. I think that was his first interception of the two there at the end of the game. But nonetheless, excited to see what Alex Smith can do as the starter for Washington next week. And it'll be interesting to see how the Giants move forward now with their second win on the year, 2-7, and held on to beat the Washington football team 23-20. What was, you know, a little bit of a sloppy win, but the entire NFC East is sloppy this year. So the Giants just happy they got the win. Then a fun game in the AFC West didn't go exactly how I would want it to go, but the Raiders and Chargers battled to the end. The Raiders coming away 31-26 victors. And I was really, really excited that the Chargers were not going to have a halftime lead. It was 14-14. I thought, great, the Raiders will either take a knee or they'll run the ball a couple times. They'll go into halftime tied, because that's one position the Chargers have not been in this season. They are 1-1 when they are trailing at halftime, but they were coming into this game 1-4 when leading at halftime. So I thought, great, 14-all. We'll go into the locker room tied, and we'll get to see the Chargers act as if it's 0-0 coming into the second half. And then what happens? A strip sack occurs, the Chargers get the ball back, and they kick a field goal with just seconds remaining going into halftime, 17-14 up. And I sat there in disbelief. Thought, no way did the Chargers just put themselves up at halftime and seal their own fate. And here we are, a team that is now 1-5 on the season when having a halftime lead. Gosh freaking dang it. I was so happy. I sat there thinking, great, tie game. It'll be 0-0. Maybe they'll take some of that first half game plan and roll it over to the second half. Now that it's essentially just a 0-0 game going into the third quarter. But nope, they had to go and make one more defensive play there. And what were the Raiders doing trying to throw the ball? Run it. Run out the clock. Go to halftime. But no, they couldn't do that. They had to let the Chargers make a play, get the ball, kick a field goal. So the Raiders knew that the Chargers now had a halftime lead to blow. Unbelievable. But it was a solid game from the Raiders. Chargers had a chance there at the end. Unfortunately, couldn't make the catch stand. And they fall to 2-6 and now lost 9 straight games in the AFC West. That is a tough pill to swallow. Then the Dolphins and the Cardinals thought that would be a fun game. It was absolutely, I think, the best game of the week, watching Tua and Kyler Murray go back and forth in that game. And Tua did a whole heck of a lot more in this game than he did during his starting debut against the LA Rams. I mean, 20 for 28, 248 yards, 2 touchdowns. Then on the ground, 7 carries for 35 yards. I mean, he had a lot. I mean, it just seemed like he was a lot more settled in. He got that first game under his belt, that first start against the Rams, got some help from his defense and his special teams, but in this game was able to do great things on his own, in the passing game, with his feet. That's the kind of player I think Miami is excited about, and I think a lot of their fans should be excited about. And Kyler Murray, again, as well. 21 for 26, 283 yards, 3 touchdowns. He had 11 carries for 106 yards. He was the leading rusher for Arizona with a touchdown as well. I mean, Kyler Murray averaged 9.6 yards in that game yesterday. I mean, it was fun watching those guys duke it out there in the desert. And hats off to Miami for pulling out the win as well. I mean, that's a tough-fought battle, a hard-fought battle. And Tua and the Dolphins, I think, put the Bills on notice that we don't think you're running away with this division anymore. And I'm excited to see Buffalo and Miami duke it out for the AFC East. And can't wait to see that meeting between the two of them Again, I believe they still have another meeting left on their schedule. They do. They'll play week 17, which is what I like to see there. That should be a fun way to end off the season. Hopefully, they're doing battle for the AFC East Division title on that day. In the last game from the kind of the day session yesterday, the morning and the afternoon, was the near miracle upset of the Cowboys over the Steelers. A 19-9 lead for Dallas heading into the fourth quarter. I kept waiting there in the second and third quarter for Pittsburgh just to get into gear and start separating from Dallas, and it just never happened. And I was just sitting there in disbelief thinking, are the Cowboys really going to be the team to take the zero away from the Pittsburgh Steelers? But no, they were not, because the Steelers were able to pull it out there, dominating the fourth quarter, outscoring Dallas 15-0. Of course, the touchdown for 31 yards from Roethlisberger to Smith-Schuster to make it 19-15. Of course, then the PAT was blocked, which at that point I was thinking, man, it's a day meant for Dallas to beat Pittsburgh. Then they got the field goal from Chris Boswell to make it 19-18, and still with over, a little over 7 minutes left. I thought Dallas needs a score. They didn't get it. And a little over 2 minutes left, Roethlisberger 8 yards out to Eric Ebron to give Pittsburgh the lead and eventually what would be the win, 24-19. But my goodness, what a near miracle upset from the Dallas Cowboys over the Pittsburgh Steelers. That would have been, I mean, there we've had some pretty crazy upsets so far this season, but that would have made my jaw not just hit the floor, but dislocate from my body as it was hitting the floor. I would have been so amazed. But Pittsburgh now, 8-0 start for the first time in franchise history. So we'll see where that goes. They are now halfway through their season, and they have yet to lose. Then we get to Sunday Night Football, and what a head scratcher. I mean, depending on how you feel about Brady, it was either the greatest game you've ever watched or the most horrifying game you've ever watched, as he threw for 3 interceptions for the first time since week 3 of 2011. And in his 2 combined games against the Saints this year, he's thrown 5 interceptions. New Orleans had his number, I think, because everyone was so geared up to see Breeze and Brady twice this season. New Orleans wanted to make sure that everyone knew who was still running that rivalry. And my goodness, how do you follow up a week 1 win where you beat the Buccaneers 34-23? You go into their stadium and beat them by 35 points. Kept them off the board till the fourth quarter. The first 4 drives from Tampa Bay were 3 and outs. And then an interception off 2 plays, and a turnover on downs, and another interception, and another turnover on downs, then another interception. I mean, it was surreal, really, to watch New Orleans just dismantle Tampa Bay like that. Now New Orleans has essentially set themselves up to, unless they just outright lose the division to Tampa Bay, they'll have the tiebreaker over the team that is really the only true contender in that division. Atlanta, Carolina, they're playing solid, but they're not contenders for that division. Tampa Bay was the only one, and now New Orleans has both wins over them. So the Saints put themselves in a very, very nice position. And now all that's left is Monday Night Football for Week 9 of the NFL season. We'll dive into that a little bit later on in the show. But when we come back, NASCAR has crowned their champion for 2020. And it was a fun end to the season. So we'll talk about that coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM. The 2020 season may have been interrupted due to COVID, but they finished it off with an exciting race, did NASCAR, yesterday at Phoenix, or in Phoenix, I should say, at the Avondale Raceway, or at the ISM Raceway. Goodness gracious, Spencer. But it was a fun end of the season there at Phoenix, the ISM Raceway, and I felt like as soon as the race started, it was a day meant for Chase Elliott. Because his car failed inspection twice, they were put at the back of the field. And watching the first stage, I thought, if Chase Elliott can get close to the top 15 in this first stage, he'll give himself a solid chance then to make his way back up to the front in stage 2. And by the time we get to the final stage, he'll be right there battling with the other championship contenders for the lead. Well, it took him about maybe 2/3 of the first stage, which was 75 laps on the 1 mile oval. It took him about 2/3 of those 75 laps to get to the championship contenders. The way that Chase Elliott was carving through the field on a one-mile track, and granted, I mean, Phoenix has that dog leg right as you come off the start line that you can just obliterate the turn and go right down onto the apron. So it's a speedway that I feel like is relatively wide at times for being just a mile oval, but still, the way he was carving through people, it was just unreal. I mean, again, watching him go from, you know, whatever it was, 36th or 37th, wherever he started the race, the back of the pack. I remember watching the first, you know, 15, 20 laps, and all of a sudden he's in the top 25, and all of a sudden he's in the top 20, then he's in the top 15, and it just felt like it was his race that he was going to go out there and just prove that no matter where he started, he was going to finish the champion. And again, starting the back of the pack, led the most laps yesterday. 153 of the 312 laps were led by Chase Elliott, Joey Logano, the only other driver to get over 100 laps led. He led 125 laps. Brad Keselowski led 16. Denny Hamlin, the only championship contender that did not lead a lap yesterday. But just a great, great effort there from Chase Elliott. It was a fun battle, too. I mean, there were times when Denny Hamlin, Joey Logano were fighting each other. I mean, really, once Chase got up to the front, all four playoff contenders were having some fun battles with each other. You don't always see the top four right up front there. I mean, past races, you know, that not every time has the championship winner and the championship four won the race even. But it's always, it just feels a little bit more, just feels right when a championship contender wins the championship by winning that last race. Because technically, it's just whichever one of those four finishes the race first. So if they finish third, fourth, you know, seventh and ninth, the driver that finished in third is the first of the championship four to finish, so he would have won that title anyway. But it just feels, like I said, just feels right to see one of a championship contender win the championship by winning that last race of the season. It was Chase Elliott's third win of the postseason as well. Of the 10 playoff races, he won three of them, the Roval, Martinsville, and Phoenix. So that's not a bad showing either there from Chase Elliott to win his first Cup championship, and did it as the third youngest driver in Formula One. Bill Rexford is the youngest. Back in 1950, he won the NASCAR Cup at 23 years, 7 months old. 23 years, 7 months, and 15 days old. And then Jeff Gordon in 1995 was 24 years and 3 months and 8 days old. And now Chase Elliott, the third youngest driver to win the Cup at 24 years, 11 months, and 11 days old. And in terms of champions under 30, he joins a pretty impressive group as well. Mentioned Bill Rexford, but Jeff Gordon, while he was under 30, won it, what is that, 3 times while he was under 30 years old. So he had that kind of an amazing accomplishment as well, to win it 3 times before reaching 30. But Dale Earnhardt won at 29 years old. Ned Jarrett at 29. You had Brad Keselowski back in 2012 at 28 years old. Herb Thomas at 28. Tim Flock at 28. Joey Logano a few years ago in 2018 when he won it was 28. Terry Labonte won it in 84 at the age of 28 years old. Richard Petty at 27. So, I mean, just an incredible group of drivers under 30 to win a championship. And now Chase Elliott, a part of that group as well. And he and his father as well, Bill Elliott, also just the third father-son duo to win NASCAR Cup titles. So pretty cool moment as well to see Chase Elliott embraced by his parents and everybody there at the end of the race. But what a fun Sunday. What a fun race again to have all four title contenders there finish in the top four, going Elliott, Keselowski, Logano, and Hamlin. That's really what you want to see. You want to see those four guys up front competing with each other, competing as hard as they can. And also it was a nice feel-good moment there to see Jimmy Johnson round out the top five in his final NASCAR race, obviously the 7-time champion there in NASCAR, closing out his career with a top five finish. I mean, that's a pretty cool way for Jimmy Johnson to go out. Obviously, if you can't win a championship, you want to be competitive. And Jimmy there finishing, I mean, it was the first non-championship four finisher. That's not a bad place to be, obviously, if you can't be competing for a championship. But great race from Jimmy Johnson as he now gets ready to change his attention to the world of IndyCar. As he gets ready, he'll be a part of a Chip Ganassi Racing next year, just competing on the road courses, which is all of maybe, I think, four races are on ovals next year for IndyCar. They have the Indianapolis 500, obviously. They're racing at Texas, I believe. They have two races at the Texas Oval and then one other oval race as well. I think it's Iowa. But that essentially means all but four races Jimmy Johnson will be competing in next year. I'm excited to see what he can do in all those different road courses in an IndyCar. That should be a lot of fun, especially on the same team with reigning and six-time IndyCar champion Scott Dixon. That'll be a lot of fun as well. But good to see Jimmy Johnson finishing out his career in the top five there in NASCAR for somebody that's had so much success and been so much fun to watch. Good to see him having a high note there on his way out of NASCAR. And now as we get set for the 2021 season, not all that far away, the Busch Clash, which is the first event on the schedule. It's not the first kind of points paying race. Obviously, that's the Daytona 500. But you have the Busch Clash, and then of course the duel that sets up the starting lineup for the Daytona 500. But the Busch Clash scheduled for February 9th. So literally 4 months from now, the NASCAR season will start up again. 3 months from now, excuse me. My math is awful. Never claimed to be a mathematician. But let me rephrase that. 3 months from now, the NASCAR season is back up and running there. That's pretty crazy to think about. And the Busch Clash, instead of being on the oval there at Daytona, will be on the road course there at Daytona. So a couple interesting changes for the schedule next year. Not only will the Busch Clash, first off, it'll be moved from the Sunday before the Daytona 500 to the Tuesday before February 9th, in an effort to condense Speed Week down to 1 week. And the race, like I said, will be moved from the oval to the infield road course for the first time. And of course, they had their first kind of points-paying race on the road course there at Daytona this season in 2020. And I thought that it was really cool to see NASCAR on that infield course. Obviously, that's how the Rolex 24 Daytona is held, on that road course there at the Speedway, and I thought it was cool to see NASCAR take part in that. So, I mean, it's not technically an official points race, but still, to have the first race of the season on that infield road course, that'll be interesting. It's just the first event on the infield road course. I think that'll be interesting. Then the Phoenix Raceway will host Cup races on March 7th, and then again on November 7th, and it'll once again be that November 7th race will be the Championship Four again. So Phoenix, like it did yesterday, will next season also host the championship race. The Nashville Super Speedway will host a cup race, which is scheduled right now for Sunday, June 20th, which is Father's Day. But it'll be the first time the Speedway will host a NASCAR Cup Series event and the first time the track has hosted any NASCAR event since 2011. In order to put the track on the schedule, its owner, which is Dover Motorsports, moved one of the two cup races at Dover to Nashville. So sacrificing one race there on the Monster Mile to go to Nashville, which is interesting because obviously IndyCar is also set to go to Nashville this coming season, although it will be a temporary street circuit. Just interesting how, with obviously hockey in Nashville becoming huge, the Titans there, but they had the NFL draft that was there in Nashville for a little while, so it seems as though that's really starting to become more and more of a sports hub. So with NASCAR, I mean, IndyCar used to race there as well, but now that they're both going back to the city of Nashville, and NASCAR will be looking to compete on the oval there in Nashville, it'll be interesting to see how that goes next season. And then it was reported that the Kentucky Speedway and Chicagoland Speedway would not be on the 2021 schedule. And because of that, NASCAR announced the Atlanta Motor Speedway would expand to two races, picking up the Quaker State 400 that was held at the Kentucky Speedway. That'll now be put to Atlanta to give Atlanta two races on the year. And then close to that announcement as well, it was announced that Road America would be back on the schedule for the first time since a Grand National race 65 years ago. So it's been a very long time since NASCAR has gone racing at Road America. And, I mean, watching IndyCar on that track for so many years, I cannot wait to see how NASCAR drivers handle that track and manage that track throughout a race. I think that's going to be really exciting. And then, obviously, it was also announced that Indianapolis race would be run on the road course configuration and not the oval. I mean, NASCAR getting a little more intrigued, I think, by the road course. I think there is 5 or 6 road course races on this schedule, which is more than I can ever remember being on a NASCAR calendar. So it'll be interesting now to see that race at Indianapolis on the road course. Because, again, seeing IndyCar do that for some time, can't wait to see how NASCAR handles it. And the other announcement that was made about the upcoming 2021 season is that it would also feature a dirt race for the first time since 1970. As the spring race at Bristol Motor Speedway will have the concrete half mile there covered in dirt. So you get a couple more road course races next year, as well as the return of a dirt track race to NASCAR. So it'll be interesting. Never seen that at the NASCAR level. Obviously wasn't nowhere near being born in 1970. So can't wait to see what that looks like next, especially with how crazy Bristol can get just by itself. See that racetrack on dirt? Sign me up. But yeah, that's news and notes there just from NASCAR. Obviously a really exciting end of the season. Congratulations to Chase Elliott on winning his first Cup championship. And I can't wait to see what 2021 has in store. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll recap what was a fun weekend of college football coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM. Well, the wild weekend of college football. I mean, Friday had a hat trick of interesting games. First off, the statement made by BYU on the road on the Smurf turf and beat Boise State 51-17. Shut Boise State out in the second and third quarters. They put up 22 points, did BYU there in the third quarter. But BYU now 8-0 on the year, and with that kind of win over Boise State, I mean, they're not a Power 5 conference, but they're a team that's consistently close, if not in the top 25. And for BYU to do that on the road against Boise State, that's pretty impressive there from the Cougars. So we'll see what that does to them. But my goodness, BYU making a statement there on the road, as did San Jose State. The Spartans are now 3-0 in Mountain West play, beating San Diego State on the road 28-17 after having a 14-point fourth quarter, did the Spartans. So San Jose State really showing up this year, and I think that was the first kind of big test for San Jose State against San Diego State, and they went on the road and handled their business. They were down 3-0 at the end of the first quarter, down 10-7 at halftime, but the second half, San Jose State really controlled the game over against San Diego State and were able to, I mean, outscore the Aztecs 21-7 there in the second half. So the Spartans making the Mountain West known, you know, making it known that they are our contenders. They're there to play. They're there to show up and compete. And, I mean, San Jose State and Nevada now 3-0. That's an interesting picture there at the top of the Mountain West standings. But be interesting to see what San Jose State can do the rest of this year. And then on Saturday, it was good to see the Pac-12 back. I just missed West Coast football. Obviously, having the Mountain West is awesome. When you have the Mountain West and the Pac-12 going off, just makes Saturdays that much better. And Oregon with a strong showing over Stanford. Tyler Shaw there for Oregon. A great first game through the air, 17-26, 227 yards and a touchdown, but had a touchdown on the ground as well. I mean, an impressive performance from him in his first start for Oregon. I mean, you never know where a program is going to be when you lose a quarterback like Justin Herbert. You look at what happened when Marcus Mariota left the team. A few years where they just struggled until Herbert really started until he started starting as a quarterback, but also until he really got into rhythm and understood kind of the Oregon offense. He got comfortable with that level of competition. It was just a rough run there for a few seasons for Oregon, but a strong start to their season, beating Stanford 35-14 and holding the Cardinals out of the end zone, really off the scoreboard the second and third quarter. And then 9 a.m. start for the Pac-12, ASU and USC. I thought it was fun to see the Pac-12 on that early. You know, obviously West Coast games usually later in the day. It's usually East Coast and, you know, Central United States that get the games on at the noon Eastern time hour, 9 a.m. West Coast hour. But fun to see the Pac-12 on at 9 a.m. And we'll see if they continue to do that. Obviously no fans in the stands this year, so it's a little easier to make those decisions. But next year, if there are fans allowed in the stands, about a year from now, we'll see if they continue to go down that road. But I thought it was pretty cool to wake up and have Pac-12 football on the TV already. That was pretty awesome and a fun game too. I mean, my mom, as a Sun Devils fan, didn't enjoy it all that much. But USC, an incredible comeback there late in the game. A crazy bobbled catch for a touchdown, an onside kick recovery, and then another incredible grab for what would be the game-tying touchdown before the extra point put them on top and gave them the 28-27 victory. But what a game there to kick off the Pac-12 season between ASU and USC. And then, of course, UCLA and Colorado had a really fun game going back and forth. I mean, talk about high scoring between those two teams. Colorado, though, able to come away with the victory. And then Washington State as well. Strong win over Oregon State there in what was the final Pac-12 game of the weekend. But some other interesting games. Notre Dame beating Clemson 47-40 in double overtime. Clemson almost survived their Trevor Lawrence-less games on the schedule. And although the step-in quarterback, DJ, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name. If you've listened to the show before, you know it wouldn't end well. I don't do well at pronouncing those kind of lads. Just you know, unique names in sports. Don't have a good track record with that. So just call him by his first name. DJ did a great job for Clemson. He's done a great job in the two games that he's played. Notre Dame, though, just having a really solid performance. I mean, they struggled in the third quarter, but really the other three quarters of regulation, I feel like they were controlling the game against Clemson. Then in overtime, their defense stepped up, made a couple huge plays there in that second overtime possession for Clemson, and were getting a few sacks and just putting the Tigers in a tough spot. So Notre Dame able to upset Clemson 47-40. We'll see if that. I don't think it's going to knock Clemson out of the title picture. I think, you know, the committee there, the College Football Playoff Committee, I think will take into account they didn't have Trevor Lawrence during these games, so I don't think they're gonna punish him too harshly in terms of their ranking. But this could throw Clemson's season for a bit of a loop. So we'll see how that affects the Tigers moving forward. But a great win there from Notre Dame. And then the Florida-Georgia game, it looked like it was going to be a tight game in 14-14 at the end of the first quarter. And then Florida just said, see ya. They outscored Georgia 24-7 in the second quarter. Unreal. 38-21 was the score at halftime for Florida over Georgia. And really, the second half was pretty low scoring. Georgia actually outscored Florida 7-6 in the second half. But, I mean, Florida in that second quarter was just unstoppable. And then Michigan, back to their Big Ten woes. Losing to Indiana 38-21. I mean, they just have not been the program under Harbaugh that everyone was expecting them to be, and no real surprise that they just continue to struggle there. While Ohio State dominated Rutgers 49-27, although that is more points than I would expect Rutgers to score on Ohio State, the 16-point fourth quarter. Obviously, the Buckeyes taking their foot off the gas pedal a little bit, but Ohio State having a strong win there in that game. And again, just a fun weekend of college football. Good to see some more teams returning. Obviously, having the few games called off there in the Pac-12 was a bummer. Now you have the Bama-LSU game in jeopardy. Michigan State's had some positives. That's forced the Auburn game to be postponed there. Texas A&M has halted activities. Of course, Notre Dame, everyone's storming the field after they beat Clemson. I was watching that. I thought, oh, yeah, that's what school officials want to see during a pandemic. A bunch of students and fans rushing the field and celebrating there at the midfield marker. I mean, you've just seen that mass of humanity. You knew someone somewhere for Notre Dame was sweating bullets. And now Notre Dame is mandating testing after those fans stormed the field. Yeah, you would imagine so. But a fun week of college football. It was interesting. It had some twists and turns, and obviously more teams getting into it. Finally feels like we are into an actual college football season. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll preview Monday Night Football tonight between the Patriots and the Jets. That's coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM. Are you ready for some Monday Night Football? How could you be when it's the 2-5 Patriots against the 0-8 Jets? I mean, this is just, it's again going to be one of those situations where it's a blowout and it's a snooze fest, or even though they're two bad teams, they still put on a pretty an exciting game, and it's entertaining just because they're both pretty bad. I mean, the way that the Jets have been playing all year, obviously 0-8, is not great. And the Patriots, the last few games, have looked awful as well. I mean, these two teams are a combined 1-9 in their last combined 10 games. Obviously, the Jets are 0-8, so they're 0-5 in their last five. But the Patriots' last win came on September 27th at home against the Raiders. Since then, New England has lost at Kansas City, at home against Denver and San Francisco, then at Buffalo. So in these two teams combined last 10 games, they are 1-9. So that tells you right there the quality that we're dealing with. And I think the big question coming out of this game is, can Cam Newton turn it around? I'm not expecting anything from Joe Flacco. Hasn't shown us anything since he won a championship all those years ago with Baltimore, and has not been great in his few appearances so far this season for the Jets. So really, can Cam Newton get back to playing the way he was playing earlier this year? Before that COVID diagnosis, he was that same kind of dual threat Cam Newton that we're kind of used to seeing. So I think it'll be interesting to see if he can get back into that rhythm. I mean, against a team like the Jets, It should be possible, if it's going to be possible at all this season. And we'll see what zero goes away. If they tie, they tie. But the Patriots are 0-3 on the road this year. And then, of course, the Jets are 0-8 on the season. So either the Patriots get their first road win, or the Jets get their first win of the season, or they pull off the rare tie. We'll see. But I'm enjoying the game. We'll talk about it tomorrow. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Peace.